Hey, welcome to the Hump Day Podcast. My name is Pastor Dylan Roberts, and it is September 6, 2017. This is Season 2, which I'm excited about. Today, I'm going to be interviewing Alex Bowman. Did I pronounce your last name right?
Yeah, Bowman.
Bowman. Alex Bowman. Now, Alex and I go back, way back in history. And, in fact, I started Herman Church, which is a church before I was here, in 1989. I met you when?
1994.
Yeah. He told me, how old were you in 1989?
1 year old.
1 year old. So I've known him since he was 5 or 6 years old.
Yep.
And now he's a senior pastor at the Orphan City Church in Boyle Heights.
Yep.
Now, while people are listening to this podcast, no one's heard of Boyle Heights. So can you tell me where Boyle Heights is and why did they name it Boyle Heights?
Okay, so, sure, put me on the spot for that. Boyle Heights is a neighborhood just east of downtown LA, just east of the Arts District on the east side of the LA River. It's also next to the East LA. Sometimes people call Boyle Heights East LA, but they're actually two different neighborhoods.
Okay, and you were raised where?
I was raised in El Sereno and Herman.
Okay, in the Herman area. Herman's like in the Highland Park area, right?
Yeah, Herman's right next to Highland Park. You also have never heard of Herman, so.
No. And that's the name of the church, Herman, which I think it's funky. The funky church named Herman Church. Doesn't make any sense to me. I guess it was named after Mount Herman.
Yeah.
But everyone was calling it the Herman Monster Church. Do you remember the monsters?
The monsters?
Back in the 1960s.
The monsters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the father's name was Herman.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that's true.
So, and then I went to then the church before that. I was at Brazier Church in Nazarene, and they called it Brazier Nazarene Church.
Christians have great nicknames
know,
for their churches.
I know, and so now I'm at Marina Christian Fellowship. We're not near a marina.
No.
No, we're not even Marina Del Rey. We're in Los Angeles, but we're called Marina Christian Fellowship. So you grew up in somewhere near Highland Park.
Yep.
So tell us about any brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child.
Okay.
I was actually born at the Sunset Hospital in Hollywood.
Okay.
Grew up in El Sereno, Herman area. Went to all the public schools there.
Okay.
Had a very, I'd say, typical middle-income white family type of thing. My father made enough money that we go on yearly trips.
Right.
So we actually went to Europe one summer.
Oh, my goodness. They made some good money then.
They made some decent money.
So you went to Europe? How old were you when you went to Europe?
I was probably about 4 or 5, so about the same time that we met. I remember being on the train in France, but we went to France, Italy. I also remember Venice, Italy really well.
Okay.
And Switzerland. But we'd go on yearly trips. We'd always go camping.
Okay.
We were kind of the typical white family you would think of.
Okay. So every year you did these vacations, and stuff like that. Do you remember your favorite vacation when you were a kid?
Well, definitely Europe.
Europe.
Okay. Europe. Another place we went to a couple times was Hawaii, and I love Hawaii enough that it's a little closer, so I've been able to go back a few times.
Yeah, but Europe's a far flight.
Yeah.
That's a lot of flight for a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old.
I also be a kid, I heard.
So did you grow up in the church?
Yep.
So your parents went to church?
Yep. Every Sunday we'd go to church. We actually started going, we were going to a church in Burbank for a long time. But when the Northridge earthquake happened, that's when we went to Herman Church because it was a lot closer. It was only about a mile from our house.
I remember the Northridge earthquake. That was crazy. And so you went in 1992, so you came to Herman.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember when you first started Herman?
No, but people tell me of when I first walked into the church and I cried and I didn't want to leave my mom and I didn't want to be in the nursery.
See,
I hear that story all the time.
That would drive me crazy. Oh, I remember you. You were a crybaby. Or mama's boy. Were you mama's boy or daddy's boy?
I think I was more of a daddy's boy.
Okay, a daddy's boy. So you were very close to your dad. You're going, traveling to Europe and all this stuff. So it's pretty much from age 1 to 9, you would say, typical, normal, good childhood.
Yeah. No, very, very good.
Okay.
I had a lot of good friends. I went to a private school for kindergarten and first grade. So yeah, I would say it was a very good childhood.
Okay. And you did things with your dad, or just had time with your dad alone? Or?
Yeah, my dad and I had a really good relationship. He was a social worker, okay, and he was self-employed. So he would take a lot of time off,
okay,
for us to go to these vacations. We also went to Dodger games and Six Flags amusement park. So we spent a lot of time together.
Oh, wow. Did dad actually rode the roller coasters?
Yeah. Yeah. He was the one that got, I didn't want to go on the roller coasters.
Well, I would assume if you're crying at church, you would be crying on the roller coasters.
I accidentally got on the roller coaster one time with my father.
How do you accidentally?
I didn't know.
Your dad manipulated you. He said, son, it's like American Sings at Disneyland or something.
It was in the middle. It was at night, so I couldn't see the whole track. And I got on and said, what is this? This is bigger than a car.
This is really going on.
Why is this doing this to me?
Yeah. Oh, I hate you, Dad. Or you're going down. No, I was 13 years old until I rode my first roller coaster. And it was totally by peer pressure. Because they would call me a wimp. They would call me all kinds of unpolitical names, you know, that reference to gay. And so I felt pressured, and I didn't mind it. It was the first loop roller coaster.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, did you notice that did your dad begin to withdraw from you at that time?
I wouldn't say withdrawal, but there was a period when I was 9 and 10 where I started realizing that my father was not like other fathers or dads. That's when I realized that there was something different about him, and later I found out that he was bipolar.
Okay.
So he had a mental illness, and I remember him showing up one day to my school when I was in fifth grade, and I realized that nothing was normal at that point, or something was unnormal.
Okay.
So I actually told him, I was like, Dad, just go home.
Okay.
And I was 10 years old.
He angry or just like in a depression or?
I don't remember.
You just knew it was different. You just don't want to go home.
I knew he was different and he was kind of moody.
Okay.
And so I didn't want him to be moody around me at school. Right. So I just told him, Dad, go home.
See, that's typical where children can automatically go, okay, what's acceptable at home is fine. But when we want to project that, look, Dad, if you're having a meltdown or something, do it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Don't do it in front of me. And that's hard on a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, so then there's one emphasis, one day, I can't even pronounce the word, the day that something just changed your life.
Yeah.
And so you woke up in the morning, I'm assuming. Normal day, right?
Normal day. It was August 30th, 1998. It was the week before fifth grade was going to start. So it was a very normal summer day.
Okay.
My dad was taking some time off from work because I was home.
Right.
And I woke up. I remember eating cereal. I remember watching The Price is Right because that's what I would do.
The Price is Right.
I'm watching My Price is Right.
Okay.
And I went into the backyard.
Now, was your mom home at the time?
No.
It was just you and your dad?
No, just me and my dad. My mom was working at the time.
Okay.
And so I went in the backyard and to pick up my toy guns.
Okay.
And my dad said, hey, why don't you come out here and let's play together? I said, no, I'm going to go inside and I'm going to finish The Price is Right. So I went inside, finished The Price is Right.
Right.
And then when I went back, that's when my world shattered.
Okay, so let's go. So you walked out to go play guns with your dad, I guess, because you watched your Price is Right show. And then did you find your dad immediately, or
So basically, once I walked, my backyard's really big.
Okay.
My backyard's really big, a bunch of trees. So it was about 50 feet into my backyard is when I actually saw that my father was dead.
Okay. So your dad committed suicide.
Yeah, I didn't know that at that moment.
Okay.
All I saw was there was a lot of blood. I saw his face, and it was torn up. I ran inside, called 911. You know, as a 10-year-old, I'm trying to describe what I saw.
Do you remember the call?
I remember the first call.
The 911.
The 911 call. So I actually had to call twice. The first time, you know, I'm trying to describe to them what's going on. I ended up hanging up the phone, going back to my father, trying to see if he was alive.
Right.
And when I realized that he was completely dead, I went back and I called them. I said, "Nope, my father is dead."
Okay.
And that's when they called. And I actually had to call my mom to come home from work. And I said, "Mom, come home, come home."
Okay.
And
did she go, "Why?"
I said there was an emergency, something happened to Dad, and,
okay.
and she came home. By the time she came home, the police and paramedics were already there, but
okay.
I remember greeting her when she's running out her car door and say, "Dad's dead."
You told,
I told
your
her.
Mom, "Dad's dead."
Yeah.
How did he commit suicide?
He had a shotgun, and he shot himself in the face.
Wow. And so as a 10-year-old, okay, that, first of all, you catch your dad, you looked at his face, then you call 911, running back, seeing if he's alive, running back, then calling mother, and then you were the first one to tell your mom.
Yeah.
That is heavy on a 10-year-old child.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming your mother was hysterical, or was she?
Yeah, I mean, she's crying and weeping. We loved my father very much. So in that moment, I mean, it's crazy. It's just crazy what's going on and trying to even understand it.
Right.
I think in that moment, by the time I had called my mom to tell her to come home, that something else kicked in me because, you know, I told her what had happened. And in fact, I said, "Don't go back there.
Right.
Don't see my father." Because I had seen him.
Right.
And that was not an image that I wanted my mom to see.
Right.
And so even as a 10-year-old kid, trying to protect my other parent, immediately clicked in. And in a way, I became a parent.
Yeah. In a way, you were trying to protect your mom from something that you saw. And as a 10-year-old child. So when we look at this, where all of a sudden your world just collapses, did you struggle with, "I should have played with my dad"?
Yeah.
If I just, you know, did you hear the gun go off?
I did not hear the gun go off, which is, for several years, I was trying to figure out, like, what happened. I was trying to come up with some conspiracy theory to just say that it was not my father, you know.
Right.
But for a long time, it played in my head, if I had just gone out.
Right.
If I had just gone out and played with him at that moment, maybe something else wouldn't have happened.
Right. And do you still struggle with that now? Or
No. Not at this point. I think at this point, I realized that if I had stayed back there, something worse might have happened because he was so depressed that he had decided to take his own life. Something worse might have happened if I was back there.
Yeah,
so
that's a good point. That's a good point.
So at this point, about 8 years ago, I started thinking about this, that it was a good thing I wasn't back there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That almost like a protection mode, like God goes, "No, go watch The Price is Right."
Yeah.
Okay, so then, obviously, you started school. Like a week after that, you had your funeral.
We had a memorial service. I don't remember when it was.
Okay.
It was probably pretty soon after the death. But I went back to school. The end of that week of school, my teacher had like a class meeting saying, "Look, everybody, Alex's father has died."
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's mourning, he's hurting.
Let's be nice to him. In front of you?
Yeah, in front of the class.
Okay.
And, you know, and the it was a nice thought, and I appreciate the teachers for doing that. But there was this one kid that had bullied me the year before, and he actually came up to me after that meeting and said, "At least your dad had the courage to die," like, to my face, and like, "You're a wimp."
Are you serious?
Yeah.
See, children are just evil. I mean, that is cruel. And then the thing is, you're living it now.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Even, 20-some years ago? 20 years ago, that you still remember some stupid little kid saying things like that.
Yeah.
And so... So now you're messed up.
I was definitely messed up. I was a mess.
Which, as a 10-year-old, what grade are you when you're 10?
I was in fifth grade.
Fifth grade. So now your whole life, what you've known, is completely over.
Yeah.
Now you have these issues that are just, that are deep issues. Bullying with a kid, the loss of your dad. So, did you, as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, or even... as a junior high school, do you ever question God? Like
I've gotten that question a lot.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not original.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Not the first time I've heard that.
Shoot.
So, I questioned a lot of things.
Right.
I questioned myself. I questioned my father. I questioned my mother. In some ways, I questioned friends of the family or some of the family that was around telling me, like, oh, we love you, and then they would disappear for months. But I never questioned God in the way of, like, oh, God, you hate me. Why did you do this to me? So in context, my mom had to work more hours to make up just enough money so we could get by.
Right.
And so I would take the bus to school by myself. I would take the bus home from school by myself.
Right.
And I'd be home alone for 3 or so hours. This is right after my dad's dead.
Right.
And I'm sitting in my room contemplating life as a 10-year-old. And I think, God, if I need you, God, because I literally have no one else here with me right now.
Right.
I have no one. And that's when I really had... I knew God because I grew up in the church. Right. I knew all the Sunday school stories. I believed in him. But that was the time my faith became real for me, where I had no one else to go to.
Right.
And so in some way, I was forced to go to him.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. That's when I really ended up reading the Bible time after time after time in my room. Really trying to find some kind of comfort in the midst of the crazy world I found myself in.
And comfort and stability.
Something.
Yeah. And so you were part of the Herman Church. And this is interesting because I was a staff at Herman Church. I left in June of the same year. And your dad died in August.
Yeah.
And so I didn't think you were 5 or 6. So because for the life of me, I was racking my brain here trying to figure out, because I couldn't remember you as a child, and I couldn't remember you. I would think I would remember someone committed suicide at the church. Was the church supportive at that time?
So generally, yes.
Okay.
I would say generally, yes. There was a group at the church that was definitely more supportive, and this was the Daniels Bible study.
Okay. Dan Daniels,
okay. Caroline Daniels, Sally Gear, Barry Gear, Gwen. There's a group there.
That was solid.
That was solid. Yeah. They knew God to their core, and they were the most stable people at that church, and they loved me deeply. Okay. We went to their Bible studies every Sunday evening, and nobody cared for me at that church like they did.
Okay. Well, that's cool. And it's sad because Barry Gear has passed away.
Yeah.
Dan Daniels has passed away. And so...
Bill McKinney has passed
away. Bill McKinney, who led the group.
Yep.
Who led the group. Has passed away as well, and that's since 1998, so it's only 20 years ago. So they were like your support, they were like your emotional father figure, I would assume. I didn't know that about Barry. That's really interesting too. And so now somehow, let's jump here, you were hearing God's calling,
and
to ministry. And I always tell people, do not go in the ministry. You're dumb. There's no benefits. You have to, because I've been in the ministry now 35 years. You're dumb. Okay. You have to know, without a doubt.
Absolutely.
It is a calling from God.
Absolutely.
And so when did you, obviously it was during the Herman days.
It was during the Herman days. So if we fast forward from my dad's death, I start spending time after time with God. And in fact, in about 3 years after my dad's death, I'm walking in the middle of Pacific Christian High School, which was a high school in the community of Herman, in lunchtime, and I hear this audible voice saying, "You're going to be a pastor."
Really?
And
are
I
you
said,
going to Pacific Christian?
I was going to Pacific Christian.
Oh, I'm it sorry. You went there too. You know, good night. You know, no wonder you. Because I graduated from Pacific High School in 1981.
Yeah.
And so it's a funky little school.
Yes, funky.
So you're in the field and you heard this audible voice.
Yeah. I heard it and it was clear as someone standing right next to me.
I didn't know that.
And so you're going to be a pastor. And I said, okay. Like, I don't know what that means.
How old were you?
I was in eighth grade, so 14.
Okay, wow. So you knew it from then.
From then. But the funny thing was, before that, I had planned on being an astronaut. All kids say they want to be an astronaut, but I had planned out where I was going to go to school. Okay. I had planned out the classes. I was writing my speech for when I took the first step on Mars. Like, that's really? Serious, yes. Oh, and now, wow, you know, someone's going to end up walking on Mars.
Just go work for Elon Musk.
No, he's right down the street from you.
Yeah, we got a guy that works for Elon Musk.
I heard. So I was planning on that, and God tells me, I want you to be pastor. I have no idea what that means, but I say, okay. And I went to tell my mom.
Right.
I'm going to be a pastor. And my mom said, you know, you're stupid. Why you got to go do that? People in ministry don't get anything. You're going to be a scientist. You'll make a lot of money. I said, I know.
That is so true. Everyone just discourages you from it.
God said, I'm going to. She's like, no, you can do that after. I'm going to do that. And so that's when I started trying to figure out what being a pastor meant, what ministry meant. So.
Did your mother tell you that Mars is probably safer than being a pastor?
No, but it probably is.
Okay, go ahead.
I started helping out at Herman Church with their Sunday services by running the computer for worship.
Okay.
Or at times when the computer wasn't working, you know, the
now
little
slide projector. Now, this is when AJ was, or Don Bowers.
No, this was when AJ Morrow was pastor.
Okay.
So this was still early 2000s.
Okay.
Or it was right at the time where Don and AJ were transitioning.
Okay.
So I started helping out that way. And then I found myself in the youth group, and I eventually led a small group in the youth group. Mm-hmm. The youth group collapsed. And I remember going to AJ one day, I was senior in high school, and said, the youth group must come back.
Right.
We have to bring it back. And at that time, AJ had Daniel Morales lead it with me helping Daniel Morales. Mm-hmm. And that's when I took my first really big step.
Was partnering with Daniel Morales.
Partnering with Daniel Morales. Okay. Yeah.
How did you and Daniel work together?
Pretty well.
Okay.
Pretty well. I handled some administrative stuff. He led it kind of every Wednesday. He led most of the groups, and I was just there to kind of support him and help him with anything I could.
Okay. So was he a vital part of helping you fulfill the ministry, or was he not?
He was. He was. And I say that because I needed to learn a lot of things.
Right.
And in that place of helping to lead a ministry, I learned a lot. One of the things that Daniel did that is, I think, the most amazing things I've seen was that he took everybody that helped him every month, and we had breakfast together.
Okay.
He poured into our lives because he knew that we needed to be poured into. Right. And I will never forget the pancake breakfast that we would have.
You know, it's funny because Daniel is at Pasadena Church.
Yep.
And totally, he's been hurt by the Hermit Church, and he thinks his life is, and he was on the podcast sharing about this. So it's really interesting to hear that he made a vital impact on your life, because I think to this day, he just focuses on his hurts, and he doesn't realize the impact he made on other people's lives.
Yeah, I think I would see that. I was at the Hermit Church when Daniel was hurt, and I saw that whole process go down.
Yeah.
But I would not be pouring into people the way I do if it weren't for how he poured into me.
Okay. That's good to hear. Because we were talking, you and I had a pre-interview. We just finished lunch, and we were talking about Hermit, the Hermit Church, and for me, when I first started, I told you this, Mark Logan, who was the director of our Free Methodist Camp, Oak Glen Christian Conference Center, he asked me, he goes, what church do you ask me at? And I go, Hermit. He goes, the first thing comes out of his mouth, that's a church that kills its pastors. And I went, ooh. And it does.
The first thing you hear, that's great, right?
That's the first time it kills the pastor. Because I went through a divorce at Hermit.
Yep.
AJ, who followed Don, went through a divorce. Manny almost went through a divorce and ended up quitting. And then the other pastor did not last too long either. And it's kind of, it's a difficult church.
It is a difficult church.
To pastor. So therefore, you ended up being on staff of that church.
Yeah, and so there was a point where I was going to school. There were some transitions with staffing. At this point, Manny Martinez becomes the senior pastor. Okay. And they were trying to reconfigure the youth group. And at that point, they said, Alex, do you want to lead the junior high ministry? And I said, absolutely not.
Right.
I said, no.
No.
I was like, no, I don't like junior hires. They're the worst. Junior hires.
I was a junior hire.
We were all junior hires, and we remember how bad we were, or other people were to us. I said, no. And they said, well, pray about it. I said, okay.
Pray about it. What does that mean?
It means I want you to do it, but I want God to tell you that you have to do it. And so I prayed about it.
God to tell you.
I said, God, I really don't want to do this.
You just tell God.
It's like, God, I don't want to do this. And it was one of those, like, pray about it because you should actually pray about it. And I eventually went, said, you know okay. what? Yeah, I'll do it. And I came on staff. I actually started getting paid to do ministry at the church. And I had that role for about 3 years. And through that time, Manny ended up leaving.
Right.
And in that void, when we were kind of searching for a senior pastor, you were overseeing it, the ministry there. Two things happened in my life. One, the Hermit Church realized that I played a more pivotal role. Mm-hmm. And so I became not just the youth pastor, but an associate with larger
responsibilities.
But I also realized that I, too, wanted to be a senior pastor one day.
Okay.
Just probably not at Hermit.
Which is a smart move. I mean, you're a wise man.
Yeah. Just saying this, I love Hermit Church, but I knew my calling was not.
You
to
know,
be there.
Everything. Every time you say "but," it just negates what you say before.
I love Hermit Church, and okay. I knew that I wasn't called to stay at Hermit.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and I don't think none of us were called to be at Hermit forever, but Hermit for me was a pivotal point in my life that just I became a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And just a lot of negative things happen. It doesn't really matter. It's part of my journey, and how I'm going to end the story, it will be a positive impact.
Yeah.
A positive point. So you knew you were going to be called to the senior pastor.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to jump here. If you don't know Alex, he's married to Ashley.
Yes.
Which I have no clue how in the world he got her.
I don't know either.
She is just a beautiful young lady. How did you guys meet?
We met at her church, which was East LA Light and Life.
Okay, East LA Light and Life. And so you just happened to visit there, or just...
Well, the Herman Church didn't have a group for young adults.
Okay.
The East LA Church did. I started hanging out there, and they had a kids camp that I decided to help out with, which is when I really started to notice Ashley, and she was there.
And she was helping out at the kids camp.
She was also helping out at the kids camp.
So were you immediately attracted to her?
Yes.
Okay.
But I thought I had no chance.
Well, I did too. Because when I met Ashley, I go, you got to be kidding, Alex. She must have been legally blind. So anyway, did you start dating then?
We started dating about, I think, 2 weeks after the camp.
Okay.
So I did something very dumb. I asked her to hang out with me. She didn't understand that as a date. I was too much of a wimp to ask her out on an official date, but when we...
So you just, instead of asking her, do you want to go out on a date, you said, do you want to hang out?
Do you want to hang out? And code for a date for a wimpy kid, a wimpy man. But she was dressed in a this nice red dress. I was in a polo shirt, and I realized I'm way over my league. But we had a great time together. We saw the Help, the movie The Help. Okay. We went to the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf afterwards and talked for probably 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
And then I got to see her on a second date. And
the rest is history.
The rest is history.
So you got married when?
We got married March 1st, 2014.
2014, which I had the privilege of doing the wedding.
Yes.
Which was a beautiful wedding, and I had the privilege of doing the premarital counseling. And it was such, for me, it was such a spiritual moment of a lot of things going on. And Gus, your father-in-law, was a big crybaby. So, and if you don't know Gus, Gus is a macho guy.
Yeah.
But I kept joking. I go, Gus, get a hold of you. And but he was in love. He loves his daughter.
Yeah.
I mean, and she's a daddy's girl.
Yeah. So she's the only girl and the firstborn.
Yeah.
So I stole his prize away from him. There's a moment in the wedding where he's supposed to hand Ashley off to me, right. And I go in for a hug, and he's just standing stiff, and there's we actually have the picture of it.
All right.
And it's hilarious. I love to show that picture, but yeah, he's standing stiff, and I'm trying to go in for a hug.
You know, this is awkward, you know, but the wedding was beautiful. And so then you moved up in an apartment where I used to live.
Yep, at Herman Church.
How did Orphan City... Well, first of all, because we were making fun of church names, why Orphan City Church?
So Orphan City Church came out of... We actually had the tag name first.
Okay.
We had the tag name, The City Needs a Father. And we were trying to think of names for this church that we were trying to plant in the Boyle Heights, East LA area. Right. And we thought of like Boyle Heights Church, like East LA Church, but actually all these, if we broke it down by like the first letter of all these words, they ended up being gang tag names. So that probably weren't at work the best. Yeah, BH and ELA, they're all gangs in the neighborhood. So we're probably like, no, let's not do that.
You get advertisement on walls of commercial buildings.
Yeah, that's for us. And then we just put, you know, 10 a.m.
10 a.m.
So we're thinking, man, the city needs a father. And we're thinking, like, Father God.
Right.
Ashley's in the shower, and she pops on. She's like, I got the name, Orphan City Church. And we're thinking about it, how a lot of people in Boyle Heights, East LA, have been orphaned or cut off by the church. Or they don't understand, or they're not part of the family of God. But they're also cut out of society. Mm-hmm. If you know how Boyle Heights was made... It was literally cut out of the city by putting a bunch of freeways around it.
Right.
And in some ways, it's a forgotten place.
Right.
But the people in Boyle Heights love it. Love the culture in the neighborhood. Okay. So we thought, you know what? Orphan City Church just makes perfect sense for the church in Boyle Heights.
Okay. So when did it start?
We started January 10th, last 2 years ago. I don't even remember anymore. It has seemed so long.
Long. So it's not been an easy 2 years.
No. So, yeah, it started January 2016.
Okay. And so the thing is, when you and I were talking about this, it's like my church. It's almost like a hospital. And you were almost saying, I've got everyone that's in my church, or most people in my church, have been rejected by other churches.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a good way of saying it. And that's what I actually said. We're the kind of the church of the rejects. A lot of our people have been rejected or pushed out by the other churches that they were part of.
Right.
Either because of cultural differences in Boyle Heights, not seeing potential in people.
Right.
Or just bitterness and hurt, yeah, and, you know, things that we do to each other. Okay. So that's, we, our worship leaders, our kind of our leadership team, they're pretty much all rejected by churches that were around us.
Right. Which I was thinking during this interview, it's almost to the point your childhood and your events with your father and that stupid little kid saying those remarks, yeah, you minister out of that.
Yeah. When we talk about Orphan City Church, the city needs a father. That mm-hmm. is, you know, my story.
Yeah.
I needed a father. And when my dad died, I could have looked for a father in, you know, the way that the world finds it.
Right.
Through all those things. But because I think I was lucky enough to grow up in the church, I knew where to look, and I found my father in God. And so that's how, you know, I minister out of. I right. say, look, I understand pain. Right. I get pain. Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah.
Instead of looking to drugs, alcohol, just sex, there's a different way to go. Right. And so I get to carry that with me to the people of Boyle Heights right. because there's a lot of pain there.
Yeah. And I always say that your biggest ministry comes out of your biggest pain. And so I believe that. So while we wind down the podcast, I want to ask you a question. Two questions. First of all, if somebody was going to think, I'm called to the ministry, and we make a lot of joking, like, you have to be sure the calling. You heard an audible voice. Mm-hmm. For me, it was a strong movement in my heart that basically I heard the Lord say, if you can't find the example, then become it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember exactly where I was. You remember exactly where you were. I was in a Honda Civic, 1974 Honda Civic, in the parking lot of Brazilian Nazarene Church. I knew God called me to the ministry. So how do you tell somebody that you're called to the ministry? How do they know? If they don't have this strong urge of this feeling, how would what advice would you give?
If you don't have a strong urge, then
or not a strong urge, but you didn't hear it like you and I heard it.
I would honestly double check it okay. to see, because the ministry is not easy. It's it's no way easy. Unless you're, you know, a mega church pastor and a televangelist, you're not going to make the amount of money that
you
correlates
need to live on.
Not just that you yeah. need to live on, but correlates with the amount of work and pain you will be around. Yeah. If you're really ministering to people, you're going to be around pain.
Yeah.
And it's probably not going to correlate with the amount of money that you're making. So if you're doing it because you think you're going to make money, or you think, oh, pastors only work on Sundays,
yeah.
that's not the ministry.
Right.
If you don't feel that strong urge, go back and say, okay, God, is this something that okay. I should actually go into because I'm unsure? Okay. It's okay to ask that question. I think it's really important to figure that out right. because you don't want to go in, you know, and you're the senior pastor of a church and you realize, huh, I really shouldn't be here. And then that whole church falls apart yeah. because they're under your leadership.
And then they end up at your church because we've been rejected.
Yeah, so they've been rejected. So yeah. maybe if you want to do that, and I'll get more people, but
then you're all screwed up. And then the last question I want to do is, what advice would you give a child that's been rejected by their father? You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people go through divorce. Mm-hmm. That their father's kind of been out of the picture and doesn't visit anymore. Or, God forbid, that someone lost their dad through a drug overdose or suicide or murder. Is there anything you could tell a 10-year-old?
I think the most important thing would be to tell someone like that it's not their fault.
Okay.
I carried blame on myself
for a while. I blamed myself. And I kept thinking, if I had only done something. There's nothing that I could have done as a 10-year-old boy.
You know that now.
I know that. And so to tell that 10-year-old boy, saying it's not your fault, whether your parents are going through divorce, the father or mother has just, you know, abandoned the family, there's death, somebody's cheating on somebody, it's not your fault.
Right.
And although both of your parents, one of your parents may be screwed up, God is there.
Right.
He loves you deeply, and you can truly go to Him and find someone that loves you the way you should be loved.
Right. And yeah, in a sense, you don't have to be that orphan.
You don't have to be an orphan.
And God's a father.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This has been a good interview. I enjoyed talking to you. I enjoyed going out to lunch with you.
Thank you.
If you're interested in going to your church, you have a website?
Yeah, orphancitychurch.org. You can check us out there.
Okay, and what time do you start?
We start at 10:30 on Sunday mornings at 2516 East 1st Street.
Okay. So you're not sure, 10:30 and 10:45.
Well,
it's like we start at 10:30, but people show up at 10:45.
Yeah, 10:30s are kind of our fellowship time. 10:45 is when I start
the service.
Yeah.
So be there if you want to fellowship at 10:30, and if you want to hear the service, just come there at 10:45. Say hi to his wife, Ashley. It's good to talk to you. And remember, our services are at 10 o'clock as well, and we're starting up in October our Saturday night service. And so thank you for listening. Remember, every day is a gift from God. Join us next week as we are interviewing Jamie Miller. God bless you, and I'll see you guys next week. There you go. How do you feel about it?